Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On today's show, there's harmony and friendship on the horizon as we tackle Pitch Perfect 2. Then we'll broaden out and talk summer movies, from the ones we're looking forward to the ones we know we'll be hearing about, whether we're excited about them or not. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So don't go away.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. For music, games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts, check out Ask Me Another. Can you do math at the movies or name commercial jingles sung in Italian? Care to moonwalk with Asif Manvi from The Daily Show? Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. Play along now at npr.org/podcasts.
There's singing and summer movies on the agenda today, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week, in our fourth chair, is our pal Petra Mayer. Petra, what do you do at NPR?
I'm an editor with NPR Books.
Well, we will get back to some of the reasons why Petra is with us for this particular episode. But the first thing we're talking about today is Pitch Perfect 2. Now, Pitch Perfect came out in 2012. It was sort of a surprise hit. The expectations for Pitch Perfect 2 are higher because Pitch Perfect was so popular. Right?
See what I'm doing?
And like the first one, this one is written by Kay Cannon, and this one is directed by Elizabeth Banks. Like the last one, it stars Anna Kendrick and Rebel Wilson and Brittany Snow and a bunch of other people. It also adds Haley Steinfeld to the lineup this time around, and there are some cameos and so forth. And you might be surprised to know that our stealth Pitch Perfect expert is one Glenn Weldon. Now, Glenn, I want you to explain to me how you came to be our stealth Pitch Perfect expert.
My husband feels about this movie. It speaks to his soul, the very first Pitch Perfect film, the way that Blade Runner speaks to mine. We're very different people. I have seen the first Pitch Perfect easily 60 times. When we come back from a night out and it's late, it finds its way streaming invariably a lot. And some nights we skip just to the musical parts, and sometimes we spend a whole time. It doesn't matter what I thought of Pitch Perfect 2 in this first viewing,
right?
Because I know I'm going to see it 60 more times.
Mm-hmm.
And also, my reaction to Pitch Perfect, the first movie, was pretty neutral. I thought it was good. I thought it was deeply indebted to Bring It On, which is deeply indebted to a lot of other sports movies. Music was fine, although I think Petra, probably react to this at a once remove than either you or Steven, because this is based as a lot of contemporary songs that are covered in an a cappella style, and I'm as happened in this second film. In the first film, I a lot of these songs I just had never heard before. So
yeah.
Now in my head are only these a cappella versions of these songs. I think we should reassure people that Pitch Perfect 2 is not a radical departure from Pitch Perfect 1. I do like that it iterates. I do like that it innovates. For example, there is another riff-off, just like there was in the first film, where they kind of mash up a bunch of songs and bring them together, and one inspires the other. In this film, they elevate it a little bit. It's different, yeah, but it's very, very similar, and it's featuring a lot of cameos. And when I heard about all the cameos, I was very worried, because I thought that's a sign that it's going off the rails. I think, however, that the cameos in this film, the people that they bring in, that they've chosen to bring in, have a sensibility that is either perfectly matched to the sensibility of this film or is so very different that that's the joke.
Right.
And I really don't want to spoil too many of these cameos. It's tough.
Yeah. It's really tough in this room.
And it's been talked about a lot in the press. So if you already know about it, you know, it's not terribly surprising. And if you know Steven, it won't be terribly surprising. But there is a cameo that speaks very specifically to him. And before we get too far into this movie, we should just explain, if you're not familiar with the first one, the first Pitch Perfect was the story of a young woman named Becca, played by Anna Kendrick, who went to college and was a little bit involuntarily drafted into the women's a cappella group, which is called the Bellas. She made new friends, and she learned to accept the kind of nerdy a cappella culture, and she got a boyfriend who is in the men's a cappella group, which is called the Troublemakers, which makes no sense, because treble is women. I'm just saying.
Yep.
The Office made that same mistake. Unforgivable.
Nerd.
I'm just saying. It's a fact. So this one finds the Bellas a couple of years later. It's structured very similarly in that it starts off with a terrible event that then they have to recover from, in this case by going to the Worlds. And so that is your entire story update.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So what did you think, Glenn?
I'll just say this. If you liked Pitch Perfect 1, you're going to like Pitch Perfect 2. If you didn't like Pitch Perfect 1, maybe see it 70 times, and then it will crawl under your skin. And, you know, I already was sitting there watching, picturing the moments that I know I'm going to see a lot more. I know which ones on the streaming we're going to jump to. I liked it. I mean, I asked Faust why he liked the first one so much, and his point was that you don't see a lot of nerd girl movies. Mm-hmm. And I pointed out to him pretty much every film that Drew Barrymore has ever made.
Yeah.
And he said, no, groups of nerd girls.
Right.
And then I pointed out to him Whippet, the film that Drew Barrymore directed. You don't see this dynamic a lot.
No, it's true.
And
it's
this
true.
This is a very important thing. So I like it.
Well, one of the reasons why we invited Petra is that Petra, like me, has done a certain amount of group singing in her life. And Petra, were you a fan of Pitch Perfect?
The original one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, what did you think, Petra, of Pitch Perfect 2?
I liked it. I didn't love it.
Mm-hmm.
You will.
So the first...
Yeah, wait till the 70th
But the magic of the first one was how unexpected it was. It was like lightning striking a wad of old cotton candy.
Wow.
You know, like the stuff that you buy at the 7-Eleven when you're drunk that comes in the plastic bucket. Maybe nobody else has this experience, but I have had this experience. Striking this wad of old cotton candy and magically making a pink sugar unicorn.
There you go.
Flying pink sugar unicorn.
I wasn't
following
your metaphor.
This is vivid. This is vivid, you know? Petra.
But the second one, it's just cotton candy. It was sweet. It tasted the way I expected it to taste, and then it went away.
Mm-hmm.
It hit all the beats that I wanted it to hit. There was the riff off, you know, there was Lily whispering incomprehensibly weird and threatening things in her tiny little voice.
Mm-hmm.
There was Fat Amy being awesome. There were mashups. There was Becca's continuing music career. There was the lovely dynamic between the Bellas. But I felt like this is an instance where you just can't recreate the same magic because it's too expected now. And I hate to kind of be a buzzkill, but I'm, as a bona fide fat chick, very mm-hmm. sensitive to the way that fat chicks are depicted on screen. And I felt one of the things that was gratifying in a weird sideways way, even though puke is like my greatest fear and I hate it, and I can always skip that scene in the first movie.
Yeah.
Two scenes.
Yeah. The gross out body horror, body humor in the first movie did not center on the fat chick.
Yeah.
Whereas the entire action of the second movie is driven by horror at Fat Amy's body. And
it's true.
I could live without that.
That's true. Along those same lines, I would say, I feel like it's important to acknowledge, there's a piece that Alison Wilmore wrote at BuzzFeed comparing the first movie and the second movie, where she also points out, and this was true of the first one too, but it's more true of the second one, that there is a weird undercurrent in these movies of each of the girls in this group getting one kind of joke. The lesbian gets only lesbian jokes over and over and over again. And even, as you said, the girl with kind of the quiet voice is an Asian girl with a tiny little voice, and she's a very, very quiet Asian girl, and that kind of plays a little bit as that joke. In this movie, they add this girl who they eventually say is from Guatemala, and every single joke she has in the entire movie is about, I lived in poverty with chickens and violence. And I mean, it's just every joke is going to that same well. And if I have a complaint about the humor in these movies, that would be the complaint. Having said that, there's a ton in this movie that I really like. And I felt like it started slow, and I was pretty concerned about it at the beginning. I was like, I don't know, because the dynamic is really different when you're talking about a girl kind of discovering the weirdness of a cappella and a girl staying with the weirdness of a cappella. One of those things is more compelling to me than the other. I'll be darned, as the movie went on and you get to its version of the riff off, which is wonderful, and then you get, you know, some character moments that are great and some stuff with Rebel Wilson, who plays Fat Amy, who I think is so funny. And like Melissa McCarthy, I give her a lot of credit for being very much in control of the kind of slapsticky stuff that she wants to do. And I think she's fantastically funny. And there's a bunch of stuff in this movie that I enjoyed a great deal. And the musical stuff, I think, is really cool. There's a competition where you see a bunch of international groups or people who are playing international groups. And I went and looked up a bunch of those groups today, and they are, as I suspected they would be, they are for the most part real existing a cappella groups who perform in those styles. And so you get to see a little bit of them. There are a bunch of great cameos. I enjoyed it quite a lot. I have a couple of reservations about it, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I had more or less the same reaction. My experience with this movie was very different from Glenn's in particular, in that I raced to watch Pitch Perfect 1 in the day leading up to the screening of Pitch Perfect 2. So for me, they very much squashed together as, and I didn't have the element of surprise. I didn't have the element of this is this amazing left field thing. I knew exactly how big it was. Pitch Perfect 1, I watched and was able to predict absolutely everything that happened in it. And for me, I had a little bit of the same reaction to some of the humor. In general, I found the jokes, about half of them, just go clank for me. And a lot of that is the stuff that's borderline in various ways. The stuff with the announcers, both actors I love, Elizabeth Banks, who directed this movie, and John Michael Higgins, who I've talked about on this show before as being somebody I love. He is the new Fred Willard. He has officially stepped into Fred Willard land, including, like, Fred Willard has played the announcer who says...
Yes. He is in Best in Show,
yeah,
right?
So I think it's exactly Best in the Show. Same role.
Exactly the same role, basically.
And I found a lot of their stuff...
It was a mix. Some of it I thought was really funny, and other I thought just clanked.
That's the fascinating thing. I mean, we've already hit this, but there is, in this film, it's endemic, a winking, ironic, arm's-length racism and sexism in the jokes.
Right, totally.
Which I'm not going to wring my hands over, because you just notice it. It's exactly what Steven said. It's exactly what you said. There are a lot of well-constructed jokes here that come right out of character, and there's also that stuff.
Yeah.
And so you're like, why is that? Why are these jokes even here? And then if you watch it in an audience, which I hadn't done, you know, I hadn't watched any film, any of these films with an audience, then you go, oh, I see why they're here, because it's easy. Because look at that reaction it gets. Boom.
Yeah.
It's like the button at the end of a scene, so you don't have to actually have a real joke.
Well, and there's such a having their cake and eating it, too, with a lot of that stuff. Like, we've put it in the mouths of these absurd characters.
Exactly.
Therefore.
Right.
But in general, like, I found in both movies, especially the second one, I just really enjoyed the musical numbers.
Yeah.
I part of this movie's take on a cappella is a cappella starts as this very staid thing, and then they move through the a cappella world by offering a twist on it. And as these movies progress, they are offering more lavish and unusual twists on a cappella as it goes, to the point where they introduce what I thought was a hilarious team of villainous German a cappella.
The Germans. Oh, God.
And they're called Das Sound Machine,
so
which
good.
Just made me laugh so hard.
Thoughts I thought they were very funny.
I thought they were enormously funny.
And the first number they did, I was like, I don't get what's supposed to be that funny about this. But then as you experience them more, they're very funny.
They are basically, for music nerds in the audience, they're basically the a cappella version of Rammstein.
Yeah.
And so I found them hilarious. I found the whole extended set piece of this version of the riff off, which again, you know, contains not just the cameo that everyone knows I'm excited about, but even the central player in that they introduce is somebody I love and have loved in a million different things.
And there's a group called the Tone Hangers in that scene who I think do appear in the first one.
They are in the first one.
But not they're not all the same guys.
But there's a new edition.
It's not all the same
that
guys.
You will go,
yeah, you scan their faces and go
Yeah, exactly.
And just say the Germans, though.
The Germans are so funny.
The amount of effort it takes to keep up that bad of a fake German accent while you're singing.
Yeah.
I actually looked them up to discover if they were really German. And I discovered that the guy is, and not only...
The guy, can I just say, with the best name ever, Flula Borg is his
Flula
name.
Flula Borg. He's a DJ, but he got his start as a Schuhplattler. And if you know anything about German culture, Schuhplattler is their version of Morris dancing. It is the most Bavarian thing you can possibly do. They used to do it at Blob's Beer Park up in Maryland. You wear the lederhosen, and you wear the silly hat, and you thump, jingle, jingle, thump, and you slap your shoes a lot.
Awesome.
It is the best. And, you know, perhaps it is uncool of us to make fun of Germans, but frankly, I'm about as German as a truck full of cabbages crashing into a pickle factory. My name is Petra. Come on. I can make fun of Germans.
We recognize they are German jokes, but they are funny, and we give them a little bit of room.
I was like, I wanted them to do some Kraftwerk. Would that have been too on the nose?
A little on the nose.
Maybe a little on the
fun,
nose.
Fun, fun, fun.
Fashions.
On the Autobahn.
Yes.
Come on.
Fashions by Right Said Fred, which I enjoy.
Heck yeah. So they were too sexy for their shirts.
So you enjoyed the Germans.
Yeah. I just enjoyed the louder and busier this movie got, the more I enjoyed it. And I don't know if that's just me reacting to loud noises and shiny things.
Yeah.
But I also find, in general, with both movies, they're not on quite as sure footing with some, not all, but some of the character development. I mean, very, very early on in the first movie, and again, I just watched these back to back, they introduce the Anna Kendrick character. She hears a piece of music and goes, "Oh, you know David Guetta?"
Yeah.
Like, she's supposed to be like the edgy one, but she's
so not.
I know. She's teen movie edgy.
No,
yeah,
and
exactly.
One of the things that I pointed out about Pitch Perfect 1 when I saw it, I literally did a blog post about the fact that one of my favorite things about that movie was the deterioration of her manicure over the course of that movie. They actually let her manicure kind of fade.
Nice.
So that if you look at her in the middle of the movie, like, it's that it's all peeling off because she's a college girl. Mm-hmm. And to me, it felt so real that she would go to college, she would get wrapped up in a million different things. She was working at the radio station and she was in this new group and she was doing her work. And so her nail polish was peeling off. And I do feel like in this one, the sense of kind of who she was a little bit less specific and a little bit less realized. And I personally, I know that we do not all agree on this point, I miss the boyfriend. The boyfriend is in this movie a little, and his friend, who was kind of his nerd friend in the first one, is in this movie a little. And Bumper, the guy who was the exiting group leader for the Troublemakers, is in this movie a little. None of them are central to what's going on, which is cool in the sense that
I like that they're superfluous.
I'm going somewhere with this. I get that it's good that they're superfluous. It's good that it's about the girls, exactly as Faust was saying. At the same time, it gave a personal undertone to the first movie to have a story about her love life that I think was supposed to be kind of replaced in this movie with the stuff about Hailee Steinfeld and her mother and coming to kind of bring her into the group. And there was nothing in this movie that kind of felt as personal to me as the romantic story. As kind of personal and small.
It's
as
almost
the, as
sort
the
of replaced by the budding did. Music career.
Yeah,
all the stuff, the stuff in the music studio.
Right.
It's funny because I came to the screening with a friend of mine who I sing a cappella with. We sing carols at Christmas time, and she said the same thing, that it was a little bit odd to her that the boyfriend wasn't there. And I was kind of thinking about that, and I was thinking that I think it's an artifact of the first one having been so self-contained. They didn't expect it was going to be a huge hit and spawn a sequel. So the storylines, you know, they end, they're over, and then suddenly they had to, you know, it was like the fifth season of Babylon 5, where they're like, oh no, we used up all our story.
Right. It's not that I think that it has to have a boyfriend. It's that I think the specific role that was played by the love story in the first movie, they didn't find a personal story in this movie about her that was as compelling to me.
Sure.
On the whole, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. I think the people who, particularly people who get a kick out of the music, I just want to say a cappella is great.
So I'm just saying. There's nothing more fun than singing harmony.
A cappella is great. Singing harmony is great.
It is a good, both of these movies are excellent infomercials for a cappella. They both speak very, very well of a cappella and make it enormously fun. And I clapped in the movie theater. I never do that. I always hate it when people clap at movies, but I clapped in the movie theater.
It's
with delight. You'll know exactly when.
It's well, yeah, I did know exactly when.
Yep.
I did know exactly when. All right, well, I will be curious to hear how fans of Pitch Perfect 1 and non-fans of Pitch Perfect 1, although why would those people find themselves in Pitch Perfect 2, quite honestly?
I have a very good reason why they might.
But let us know if you see it. Let us know if you enjoyed it, and we'll be happy to hear from you on Facebook or on the blog or on Twitter. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a bunch more summer movies. There's a lot on the plates of the various studios and actors, and we're going to try to round up a bunch of it, so stick around.
Hi, I'm Kylie Reitzman, and I'm calling from Champaign, Illinois. Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and this message are from TastingRoom.com. the only wine club that fits your personal taste. Here's how it works. Tasting Room sends you a kit with sample-sized bottles of wine. You sip each one, log on to their site, and tell them which wines you liked. Tasting Room then picks wines for you based on your taste. You get your first full case 1 month later. The shipments come every 3 months from when you started. Visit tastingroom.com/NPR for the wine club where your taste is the only one that matters.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Our other topic today, now that we have covered one summer movie, we're going to talk about a bunch more summer movies. It's our summer movie preview. It's a thing we do every year. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to ask my pal, Stephen Thompson. Stephen, are there any summer movies that are on your radar as far as I'm interested to see what this is going to be like, or I expect this to be mammoth? You can separate those out or answer them together if you would like.
Boy, I could go in a lot of directions. I mean, first of all, looking at the docket of planned summer movies this year, I had two big takeaway thoughts. One was that whereas past summers have seemed to slide the summer movie schedule up to like May 1st to July 4th and then kind of put dregs later in the summer, where I feel like there's been a shrinking of the summer movie season a little bit. This really seemed to have a lot of bigger movies like in late July and early August in ways that I found surprising and promising, and maybe by the end of the summer I will find it wearying. But there's like a new Mission Impossible movie right at the end of July. You know, there have been seasons recently where really nothing after July 4th was too July 10th, say, was too terribly interesting. So that was one takeaway, is they seem to spread a lot of the big movies out farther this summer than in the past. And the other is that there were just several really interesting looking movies that were not sequels. The two that jump out at me that I'm most curious to see, one is Tomorrowland. It's George Clooney. It's a very elaborate looking world building story that I'm very, very curious about.
Out of Disney, about Disney. Tomorrowland.
Right, about Disney's Tomorrowland. It's directed by Brad Bird, which for me, there hasn't been.
That's
for
your blessing from the Pope.
Yeah, that for me has been a 100% across the board hit rate. I've liked everything Brad Bird's done.
And the experience of researching for this segment was to look at a lot of different trailers. And I admire the hell out of them. Marketing team behind Tomorrowland, because that trailer doesn't tell you much. That trailer gives you a scene and some flashing little bits, and that's it. It gives you mood, it gives you tone, it doesn't give you plot.
And it gives you a couple things that kind of made me say, like, that seems cool. Like, there's a thing of George Clooney and this young woman, I guess, in like a bathtub traveling. And I kind of think, that looks neat.
Yep.
Like, I would watch that just based on that particular little thing.
Well, my reaction to that main trailer was, I want to see it, and I don't want to know anything more
about
it.
Yeah.
And that is a very tricky needle to thread.
Right.
Because I know that there is this, you know, that there is this other world, and that she's pulled back and forth between these two worlds, and that's all I need to know.
Right.
It looks so cool. It looks visually striking. And like I said, I mean, I'm not a big Mission Impossible guy, but Brad Bird's Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol is a terrifically, wonderfully kind of visually dazzling action movie.
All right.
So that's one. And the other I've talked about endlessly, the countdown has been going for months and months and months on this, is the Pixar movie Inside Out.
Yes.
Yeah.
And as much as...
It's a girl. She's not a princess. Woo!
It's all about her emotions.
It's a girl. She's not a princess. Yes, it is about her emotions, God forbid. I certainly intend to attach to it no matter how good it is.
Yeah.
The director is Pete Docter, who did Up, which is my favorite Pixar movie. And, you know, Pixar, it's not 100% hit rate from Pixar. I'm not a big Cars guy. But, I can't imagine that I'm not going to be moved.
Plus Amy, right.
The voice cast includes Amy Poehler. It's the plot of the film. It's about an 11-year-old girl, but then it is the five central emotions that are competing for primacy in her life, kind of within. So it's...
Where disgust is a primary emotion.
Have you ever met an 11-year-old girl?
Okay.
As it is for us all.
Well, there is... That one is my pick for this number two film of the summer.
Now, you're talking box office.
I'm talking box office, yes.
You're talking domestic.
Summer box office. I'm saying it's going to come in number two under the Avengers. That's my pick.
Okay, under the Avengers. Petra, are you excited about anything in particular?
Well, Steven stole Inside Out, which was the one that I...
Sure.
It's interesting that you ask me to talk about summer movies, because I watch about four movies a year, and the rest of the time I'm reading books for work. Not that I'm really complaining about that. So actually, the movie that I am most excited for, I'm going to just come right out and say it, Shaun the Sheep.
Tell me more.
I don't know if you guys are familiar with Shaun the Sheep. It is a charming British claymation TV show for children that's a spin-off of the Wallace and Gromit movies.
Yep.
Shaun the Sheep was a character in A Close Shave, I think, which is the third Wallace and Gromit movie, and I love Wallace and Gromit with all my heart. I love everything that comes out of Aardman Animation. I feel about them the way Steven feels about Brad Bird.
Mm-hmm.
This is not directed by Nick Park, who's the creator of Wallace and Gromit, but it is his studio. It is Aardman Animation. I love the character. I sometimes, when I want comfort TV, will watch the TV show. I just, you know, it's cute and British and it's claymation.
Shaun the Sheep.
Pretty much ticked all the boxes for me. There's also a film which I'm sort of interested in and sort of dreading called When Marnie Was There, which is rumored to be the last film coming out of Studio Ghibli. I don't know. They've been kind of on the verge of shutting down for
those conversations go around and then it hasn't quite happened
so
yet.
So this
it
is
seems
not
like maybe.
Yeah, this is again, this is not Miyazaki. It's not the guy who's most associated with Studio Ghibli, but it is a Studio Ghibli film, and so I will go watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then of course, you know, Magic Mike XXL.
One of the obligatory like 30 sequels.
Well, and Magic Mike XXL brings us around to this idea that there are a certain number of movies that just have to be kind of dealt with. Like there is Magic Mike XXL. There is Jurassic World.
Oh, that's my pick for number 2, by the way.
Which is cool for me because it has Chris Pratt in it, and you all know.
Yeah, for sure.
You all know.
For sure.
There's Ted 2.
Yeah.
The Seth MacFarlane Dirty Teddy Bear movie.
Oh, I thought it.
Part deux.
I thought that was Guy Raz.
The sequel.
That's the Ted 2 radio hour.
The phrase Seth MacFarlane Dirty Teddy Bear movie never needs to be said in front of me ever again.
No. I found the first Ted to be funny, but very thin. Certain parts of it I thought were really good, but as an entire movie, I thought it was very thin. I can only assume that a sequel will be thinner. That will undoubtedly make a certain amount of money. There's a new Terminator movie.
Yep.
Terminator Genesis. There is Minions, which is comes out of the Despicable Me-iverse.
That is my number 2 pick.
Okay. Yeah.
Again, we're talking box office.
Yes, we are.
Absolutely. And there's Mad Max Fury Road, which is just coming out this week and which is already getting fantastically great reviews from lots and lots of people.
Yes, and I think Chris Klimek and I should be doing a small batch on that sometime next week.
Yep.
We're getting off kind of light on superhero films, relatively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
We've got two coming up, Ant-Man versus the Fantastic Four.
That is not one movie.
I know, that would be awesome.
It should be.
I don't know if it would be. Ant-Man is directed by Peyton Reed, starring Paul Rudd. It has had a contentious history. It was originally slated to be directed by Edgar Wright. I know for a fact that when I go see that movie, even if it's great, I'm going to be imagining the Edgar Wright film that I'm not watching because it was just hugely disappointing when he stepped out. That compared to the Fantastic Four film, which is directed by Josh Trank, which has also apparently had a contentious development process. And some studio people are talking about Josh Trank's erratic behavior during the filming, and he was taken off of the Star Trek spinoff that he was assigned. Between these two, I'm trying to figure out which one is going to make more money. I don't have high hopes for either, per se, but Fantastic Four is a known property that people might be sick of.
Yeah.
And Ant-Man is an unknown property that has Paul Rudd.
Yeah.
So which of these is gonna win out? Well, I'll tell you, Ant-Man has a much more loaded weekend. It's coming out on a weekend with Trainwreck, the Amy Schumer film, which I am looking forward to hugely.
Judd Apatow directed.
It comes out with a film by Woody Allen called Irrational Man, which the blurb of that leads off with a tormented philosophy professor. And I was like, I'm out.
Yep. Gone.
Seen it.
Chew my own leg off.
Yeah.
Get away.
And the other film that's coming out that weekend is an interesting one called Mr. Holmes. It's Ian McKellen as Sherlock Holmes, a retired Sherlock Holmes who has to come back in for one more case.
And but he's in his 90s.
He's in his 90s, and it's directed by Bill Condon, who directed a small, weird little film called Gods and Monsters with Ian McKellen back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Great little movie. And has since gone
greatest
on.
Brendan Fraser movie ever.
Yep. Yeah, okay.
Better even than George of the Jungle.
Go ahead, and fight me.
I'll stand up for Monkey
Prove
Bone.
Prove me wrong.
Monkey Bone.
Blast from the past.
But he's gone on since then in a much more mainstream direction with the others and Kinsey and, and Dreamgirls and the Twilight films. So he's going back to small. Now, it looks very Masterpiece Mystery. It looks very, you know, Tidy Merchant Ivy. It looks very like.
That?
Well, I know.
It's Ian McKellen.
But that looks interesting to me. So I'm going to say, in Fantastic Four, relatively speaking, has a pretty wide open weekend. It's coming out against Masterminds, which is a Jared Hess film. Jared Hess wrote and directed Napoleon Dynamite and Nacho Libre. So,
and it's one of at least three movies with Kristen Wiig in it this summer.
Totally, absolutely correct. So I'm going to say Ant-Man. Because, yeah. I mean, you can't deny the Paul Ruddiness of it.
Well, the interesting thing is there are people who are like, Paul Rudd as a superhero, as if. And then I want to say, like, oh, hey, you know when I remember hearing that? About Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
So shut up.
And about Chris Pratt.
Well, and about Chris Pratt.
And, I mean, and,
about,
Toby, yeah. and Tobey Maguire. I mean, yeah, there's no requirement.
That, absolutely. That could absolutely work with Paul Rudd. A couple of other big ones I want to mention. Coming out at the end of May, San Andreas with Dwayne Johnson. Mm. Now, Dwayne Johnson, as you may know, first of all, is the best.
Yeah.
If you saw him on Lip Sync Battle, you know that he is the best. He did do Shake It Off. It was amazing. I love Dwayne Johnson. I think he is incredibly charismatic, but also really funny. I think he has found exactly the way to inhabit his very unusual physicality in a way that uses it to its best advantage. But I can't figure out whether this movie is one anybody's going to care about. First of all, they just saw him in a Fast and Furious movie, which everyone saw. I know everyone didn't. But
I looked at it and I thought, that's a movie I might go to for the air conditioning.
Call those movies and E.G. Marshall as the president.
Yeah, exactly. You do. Another one that I would mention that is coming out in early June is Spy.
Definitely.
Yeah, with Melissa McCarthy, and directed by Paul Feig.
Yep.
So that's a team that we have liked in the past. We liked Bridesmaids. We liked The Heat. I hope to like Spy.
But for every Bridesmaids and for every Heat, there's a Tammy. And there's an identity thief.
No, I know.
But Paul Feig knows her, knows what
she does. I was
going to
say, Paul Feig is very, very good with her.
And the trailer's funny.
Yes.
There's also a bunch of movies that I think are probably riding the coattails of The Fault in Our Stars. There's Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, which is out in June. And there's Paper Towns, also based on a John Green novel, which is out in July.
Yeah.
Either one of those might be, you know, attract the hordes of palpitating teenagers.
Right. And Me and Earl and the Dying Girl is not just a movie that might potentially be riding the coattails of The Fault in Our Stars. Me and Earl and the Dying Girl was the breakout at Sundance.
Yeah.
So that's a bunch of, you know, people who are not necessarily looking for the big weepy teen movie. That was also a movie that got a lot of really, really good notices at Sundance. I have not seen it, but there are a lot of people who have been really excited about it. And Paper Towns reads to me like one of those movies where who knows until you see it, right? It could be straight up just kind of goofery, another one of these movies. But it could also be really charming. It depends on how they execute.
John Green has such a huge following that it's probably going to get people...
Right.
Who just will go to see anything with his name attached to it.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
So have we done the full round of of what we think the second biggest grossing summer movie?
I think me and Petra did.
So I said Minions.
Right.
So that's my Despicable Me as juggernaut that no one sees coming, even though the last time Despicable Me thing came out, it was a juggernaut that no one saw.
So that's your behind Avengers.
That's
You're
my,
saying Minions.
So I'm saying the Avengers Age of Ultron is the top grossing, and then second, I say Minions.
And what do you say, Glenn? You say
Inside
second
Out.
Is Inside Out, and you say second is?
By the power of Chris Pratt, Jurassic World.
And I am going to go with Mad Max Fury Road.
All right, so we've been predicting success. I'm curious because I think we all brought one. What do you think is most likely to be this summer's boondoggle, this summer's cutthroat island, if you will?
I will pick from a couple. Certainly it could be Aloha, but I also think it could be Ant-Man, which I am excited about seeing. Or it could be Tomorrowland, or it could be Fantastic Four. Those are all ones that I personally am looking forward to seeing, but that I just don't know how they're going to play. How about you, Glenn?
It's either Terminator Genesis, which is, you know, it's the one that's been promoted the most of all of these films.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen trailers for this for the longest time, but it's not getting good buzz, and it just looks like it could go south very easily. Or The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which comes out August 14th, starring Henry Cavill and Armie Hammer, which I call Cheekbones and Cheekbones. They are kind of like the Veronica and Betty of Beefcake.
Yeah.
But to be fair, Henry Cavill in that 30 seconds of that trailer displays more charisma and actually personality than he does in the entirety of Man of Steel. So I'm kind of looking forward
Not
to that.
Not hard to do.
Yeah.
Petra, how about you? Boondoggle.
Hold on to your hats. I'm going to agree with Glenn.
Mm-hmm.
I think Terminator looks like the biggest boondoggle. I mean, the last one was terrible.
It was.
This one, yes, they've brought back Arnold, but that's not a guarantee of anything except glorious comedy accents, which we know I'm a fan of. But,
right. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's funny, the one that I had brought that I was so sure of is Pan, the Peter Pan movie that was supposed to come out in late July. Has Hugh Jackman apparently doing some big acting as Blackbeard the Pirate. Has kind of a cutthroat island-y feel for me, but it's already been pushed back to fall, which means that I win.
Yeah, it's true. Your boondoggle has already been undone.
So it's been doggled.
You probably win. All right, in a moment, we are going to do our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week, and we will be right back.
NPR One is a new audio app that connects you to a stream of public radio news, stories, and now podcasts curated for you. Great storytelling and rigorous reporting that informs, engages, inspires, and surprises. Available whenever, wherever. Download NPR One from iTunes or Google Play. NPR One is public radio made personal.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Jessica, why don't you hit me with a little bit of tape?
One thing you know for sure, my love for you is deeper than any root of stone. Mama told me so, don't walk the streets alone. One thing I know for sure, my love for you deeper than any root of stone. Mama told me so, don't walk the streets alone.
Okay, so what that is a singer named Jamal Davis performing with a guitarist named Ricky Kendall. The song they're performing is a cover of a song called Golden Train by Justin Nezuka. This was sent to me. This is what they're calling a tiny bed concert. Obviously a riff on NPR's Tiny Desk Concerts, which Bob Boylan and I created 7 or 8 years ago. Jamal Davis is a guy in his mid-20s who is in a hospital bed awaiting a heart transplant. And the guitarist, Ricky Kendall, is part of a group called Arts in Medicine. It's a University of Florida program where they go around and bring music to sick people and kind of use it as part of the healing and therapy process or whatever. And so it's this wonderful, disarming video in which this guy who's lying in a hospital bed waiting for a heart transplant is a wonderful, wonderful singer. And I just found it, incredibly beautiful. And, you know, as somebody who has been lucky enough to be involved in the Tiny Desk Concerts, seeing it spun into something so beautiful and sincere and heartfelt just warmed my tiny heart.
Wonderful. And we have a link to that video?
We will definitely have a link to that video.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I can't beat heart-tugging music, but I'm going to try. True. This film is both in theaters and it's also streaming on demand. It's What We Do in the Shadows. It's New Zealand mockumentary about vampire housemates, written, directed, and starring both Jemaine Clement and Taika Waititi. Now, Clement was from Flight of the Conchords, of course. It also features a great cameo by Rhys Darby, who played Murray on Flight of the Conchords. It's got exactly the same dry, affectless humor. It takes this very fantastic topic and finds in it and mines for the mundane, the banal, and it's just so funny, effortlessly funny. Highly recommended. The other thing, I have to talk about something that made me not happy before I can talk about what made me happy. The writer, historian Jill Lepore wrote a piece in The New Yorker this week, which she's a historian. She wrote the book about Wonder Woman that I reviewed for Slate. I reviewed it very well, but I found that she was a great historian of the creators of the character Wonder Woman, but when it came to dealing with the character herself, there was this kind of hold-your-nose distance that she kept, disdain for comics and the characters in them. So she wrote this piece in The New Yorker, which is ostensibly a review of a new comic called A-Force, where a lot of female superheroes on the Marvel side get together. And it turns out to be this incredibly glib, smirking, self-satisfied, completely uninspired and unengaged and unengaging piece about this new comic that refuses to engage at all what the comic's about. It's just easy writing. And the writer of that comic, and somebody who's been writing other comics that we've talked about on the show, G. Willow Wilson, has a piece on her Tumblr called Dr. Lepore's Lament, in which she just simply responds, not in an attack, not in a defensive, but in a just such an even-handed way that responds by saying, here's our mission statement, here's what we're doing. If you had read this, and you placed it in some kind of cultural context, which is supposed to be your job as a historian, you would have seen what we're going for, at least. And of course, this is only the first issue, and she doesn't expect her to kind of get it. But this takedown, ostensible takedown of this poor little comic, is just weird. So I highly recommend reading G. Willow Wilson's response. You don't necessarily need to waste your time on Lepore's write-up because it's so annoying.
Yeah.
But G. Willow Wilson's response is called Dr. Lepore's Lament on her blog, which we'll link to.
The thing that I thought was really, before we move on, the thing that I thought was really interesting and a little bit dismaying about the Lepore piece was that her entire approach to reviewing this A-Force comic full of women superheroes is to sit down and read it with a bunch of 10-year-old boys.
Yeah.
And I thought, what is the point of that as a construct? What is the point of centering the position of 10-year-old boys? I mean, I think what she's trying to do is say, is this working as feminism? You can only tell by asking 10-year-old boys whether it is still something that ultimately is for the kind of basest parts of what she considers to be the basest parts of 10-year-old boys, that they, you know, you can see boobs and stuff like that. But I just didn't see the point to centering the reading experience of a bunch of 10-year-old boys rather than anyone else who might choose to read the book. But anyway, I also read G. Willow Wilson's response and thought it was very good. So I recommend that as well. Thank you so much, Glenn Weldon. Petra Mayer, what is making you happy this week?
Well, G. Willow Wilson always makes me happy. As you might expect, two books are making me happy this week. I just today in the mail got my advance copy of Ernest Cline's upcoming Armada. Ernest Cline wrote Ready Player One 3 years ago, one of my favorite sci-fi books of the past few years. I've only had a chance to look at the jacket copy. It looks like it might be sort of a Last Starfighter-esque tinged story about a video game that proves to be all too real. I'm vastly looking forward to this. I loved Ready Player One. The other thing that's making me happy actually comes out next week, but it is the NPR Books First Read for this month, so you can go to npr.org/firstreads if you would like to get a taste. Naomi Novik wrote the Temeraire books, which are sort of Patrick O'Brien with dragons, basically. She started out actually writing Patrick O'Brien fan fiction. So she's done a whole series of these lovely books about the Napoleonic Wars with dragons. This is not those books. This is a new standalone called Uprooted, and it's a sort of novel-length, vaguely Beauty and the Beast-inspired fairy tale. And it is so incredibly good that I just wanted to dive into it and not come out. It's beautifully written. It's set in a kind of fantasy version of Eastern Europe that reminded me, I felt like I'd been dropped into like an old Russian fairy tale illustration. It's about a girl in a village, and on the outskirts of the village, there's a sorcerer, and every 10 years he takes a girl to his tower, and then, you know, 10 years later he lets her go. And now she's different, you know, he lets her go with a fancy dress and a purse full of money, and she takes off for the city. So this girl in this village, everybody thinks her best friend's going to get chosen, and of course the minute you know you open the page and you see this setup, you know it's going to be her. But the story of what happens once she goes to the tower and meets the sorcerer and starts discovering her own power while at the same time maintaining her roots in the village, because she refuses to be taken away entirely, and the way she maintains her friendship with her best friend, and the monsters that they battle, they're just so fresh and unusual and lovely, and oh, it makes me so happy, and I'm making good book noise. Good book noise!
You are making good book noise.
So we have a sample chapter up on npr.org/firstreads. Go check it out. Uprooted by Naomi Novik. It's fantastic.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Petra Mayer. So what is making me happy this week is I spend a lot of my audiobook time on kind of genre fiction that I can half listen to, that it doesn't matter if I tune out for part of it. It has not been a way that I mostly have listened to literary fiction and kind of high-minded novels. With that said, I have been listening to the audiobook of The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins, which is a little more of a kind of a book clubby, well-reviewed kind of book. It is a mystery that is told in the voices of three women. There's a situation where one of them gets involved by seeing it from a train, and another one of them is the woman she sees from the train. And it's a kind of a mystery, suspense, thrillery thing. It has some, to me, it calls to mind Gone Girl in some ways, in that you're not really sure what's going on. You're not really sure who's a reliable narrator and not. It's a wonderful audiobook. It's read by Claire Corbett, Louise Brealey, who actually plays Molly Hooper on Sherlock, and India Fisher. And all three of these women kind of have a part of the narration. It's really, really terrific. And I am only, like, I think two-thirds through it. So if you have read it, do not under any circumstances tweet anything at me about what is happening in this book, because I'm not at the end yet. But it's great. And it's been a while since I was quite this absorbed in a book that I was listening to. So I'm very absorbed in this book. Yesterday, I was coming to work and there was a traffic jam. And I was like, yay, traffic jam, because I got to stay in the car longer and listen to more of the book. So The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins. The audiobook is what I am listening to. If you prefer regular books, I'm sure it makes a perfectly good regular book. Listen to the audiobook. And that is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow the show at NPRPCHH. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at IDislikeStephen and Glenn at GHWeldon. You can follow Petra at Petramatic. And you can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. That's R-E-E-D-Y. You can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.